Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never, as I like to say. And, we got Paul still here. But Paul, as I have to go back to what I was saying, because we ran out of time. And the whole point of yesterday's comment regarding the, because this was really about the Constitutional Convention and how the people really do have, when you really look at how a convention, it doesn't happen overnight. It's something that actually takes a lot of time. And so it usually will span a 2-year, if not more, period. And so that's what I was trying to, basically lay out. If you look at when you finally get when you get the 2/3 states, the 34th state, that state will, it'll come while that state is wrapping up its session. And then Congress will then have to go forth and figure out, where and when to call for the convention, because it'll have to be after the next general election of November that year. So in other words, the convention will probably start either in the springtime of the following year, because depending on where they put it, if they put it down in Texas, then it can happen, kind of early on in the year. But right. Nevertheless, the likelihood would be this, that it would happen, the convention would happen, and then when the convention completes, regardless of how many states attended the convention, the amendments would come back to Congress, and then Congress would present these amendments. Now, the convention could require that the amendments be ratified via a convention as well, instead of just the state legislators. Or it could be like the 16th Amendment, that the state legislators would be the ones that would ratify it. Now, the people of Oregon did not, they saw the 16th Amendment and income tax, direct income tax, as a vile thing. And so they elected a whole bunch of very conservative, non-tax promoting legislators to replace the Oregon legislature. Now, the Oregon legislature at that point in time was progressive, and they were in support of the 16th Amendment, and they were on the record of ratifying it. What they did was, when they started their session, they did not swear in the newly elected people. They said that, because we received the ratification, this ratification of this amendment, we're going to go ahead and ratify it, and then we'll, read everybody and swear everybody into their oaths, and you can start your new session. And that was a violation of the Constitution.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes. So they make it up as they go along to figure out how they can get something across the finish line. It's what progressives do. Remember, it's the end justifies the means. But that was the whole point, is that the people do have the power over this thing we call the Constitution. And the people do have the ability to, step in and say, hey, we don't like this, and we're replacing you if you are willing to vote for that amendment. And that was, I think, the gist of what they were really basically trying to assert there. So
sure, the people have the power to step in and enforce the Constitution. And frankly, I don't think it'll happen until the people realize that they do.
Right. Yes. Well, and they woke up in Oregon, and Bob Benson was the one that documented that. And so bottom line, it's one of the things that Republic Review will actually, question and challenge, many of the amendments, was it constitutionally ratified? I don't have a problem with the 14th Amendment. It is all of the amendments that happened under the progressive era. In other words, the 16th, 17th, and on, You know, the question is, were the constitutional processes followed or not? So before we move into the next part of the Pennsylvania debate, which would be, this is where we get into slavery.
Right.
What I'd like to do is, you know, do you have any saved rounds, any comments? Because we kind of we're going along here kind of at a fast clip. It seems like a fast clip. And so any insights or anything you want to share?
We are going at a fast clip. But what I notice here is that, and as you mentioned earlier, it doesn't look like they have the anti-federalists. You would think from reading this document that Mr. Wilson was the only, probably one of the only people to speak up in the debate. He spoke pretty much looks like every day. But I think, you know, we've got, it's possible you think that we are experiencing the perils today that rival the dawn of the Republic. But the ratification debates are that hidden gem that helps us understand that the power we the people have within the Constitution, if we'll only know it and use it. And the ratification debate seems to be that anchor. It's been hidden from us, but I would say by providence, it's here in our hands, and we need to get that out. And you and I are doing that today.
Yeah, so one of the things that we'll also note is towards the end, because I will cover this because I've captured this, towards the end, they will basically create the summary of the arguments against the Constitution and then refute every one of them. But anyway.
Is this Pennsylvania?
Yeah, this is in the Pennsylvania debates because it is unique. I've kind of really tried to help people understand the Pennsylvania debates because it was the first one. They kind of, you know, went down a very different way of doing it. And so anyway. Anywho, on page 27,
right?
If you want to go ahead and pull in the slave comment,
much fault has been found with the mode of expression used in the first clause of the ninth section of the first article. I believe I can assign a reason why that mode of expression was used and why the term slave was not admitted in this Constitution. And as to the manner of laying taxes, this is not the first time that the subject has come into the view of the United States and of the legislatures of the several states. The gentleman, Mr. Finley, will recollect that in the present Congress, the quota of the federal debt and general expenses was to be in proportion to the value of land and other enumerated property within states. After trying this for a number of years, it was found in all hands to be a mode that could not be carried into execution. Congress were satisfied of this, and in the year 1783 recommended, in conformity with the powers they possessed under the Articles of Confederation, that the quota should be according to the number of free people, including those bound to servitude and excluding Indians not taxed. These were the expressions used in 1783, and the fate of this recommendation was similar to all their other resolutions. It was not carried into effect, but it was adopted by no fewer than 11 out of 13 states, and it cannot but be matter of surprise to hear gentlemen who agreed to this very mode of expression at that time come forward and state it as an objection on the present occasion. It was natural, sir, for the late convention to adopt the mode after it had been agreed to by 11 states and to use the expression which they found had been received as unexceptionable before.
Right. And so before you go on to the next part, I think it's kind of important that their view going into the Constitutional Convention, and this is actually supported by Madison's comments in Federalist Paper number 40, that they really tried to maintain the spirit of the Articles of Confederation as it was kind of drafted, and why he went to painful, you know, measures of pointing out what parts, verbatim, the words in the Articles of Confederation that were literally word for word placed into the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And so you know, they weren't really trying to, you know, make those types of wild changes other than the fact that they really reformed government. They weren't trying to change paradigms and or, you know, the what was considered the acceptable norm. And so anyway, he's just trying to explain why it just wasn't even brokered.
Right. He makes the point that the term slave was not deliberately. Excuse me. Let me start over again. He made a point that the term slave was deliberately not used in the Constitution.
Right. Okay. So go ahead and continue. So, thanks.
Yeah. With respect to the clause restricting Congress from prohibiting the migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit, prior to the year 1808, the Honorable Gentleman says that this clause is not only dark, but intended to grant to Congress for that time the power to admit the importation of slaves. No such thing was intended. But I will tell you what was done, and it gives me high pleasure that so much was done. Under the present Confederation, the states may admit the importation of slaves as long as they please. But by this article, after the year 1808, the Congress will have power to prohibit such importation, notwithstanding the disposition of any state to the contrary. I consider this as laying the foundation for banishing slavery out of this country. And though the period is more distant than I wish, yet it will produce the same kind gradual change which was pursued in Pennsylvania. It is with much satisfaction I view this power in the general government, whereby they may lay in interdiction on this reproachful trade. But an immediate advantage is also obtained, for a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation, not exceeding $10 for each person. And this, sir, operates as a partial prohibition. It was all that could be obtained. I am sorry it was no more. But from this, I think there is a reason to hope that yet a few years and it will be prohibited altogether.
All right. So what we're going to have to do, I apologize, because I wasn't even watching the time. And actually, I'll talk about this when we come back from the break, because we're going into a hard break right now. We'll pick this up, the sentence before, and I'll read this through. But folks, we'll be right back after this promo. So please stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
And so if anybody garners anything out of this, and so I'm hoping, because the reason I'm finding these parts and going over these is because of the wokeness that we hear today and how they're rewriting history. They made the framers and all of the states out to be a bunch of slaveholders and a bunch of racists, when that is the furthest thing from the truth. And the reason this is being brought up is because there was enough contention in the Pennsylvania, because Pennsylvania was not a slave state. And they, you know, wanted to bring this up. And so Mr. Wilson here is providing, you know, one, his own personal view and the view of the framers at the convention. And he's actually giving us the insights that the design, and I've said this before, and this really comes from this citation, that the design, the mathematical design of the Constitution was to eradicate slavery. Because eventually, and I prove this because the Missouri Compromise was only 12 years after the stopping of the importation of slaves took effect, when Madison actually stopped the importation of slaves. And so the Missouri Compromise came forward, and it was a breach and a violation of the Constitution for the federal government to mandate slavery into new states. And the reason that this even happened was because the southern states, the slave states, recognized that the light was getting bigger at the end of the tunnel. They knew that they were coming out into the light and that slavery would be over. And so the Missouri Compromise actually extended the woes, you know, upon this great nation, as well as those people enslaved, for, you know, decades further. Because had they not done that, I believe that before the first president, Andrew Jackson, became president, I believe that they would have eradicated slavery by that point, had the Missouri Compromise not taken effect. Anyway, let me move forward, because this is where the sentence that was, you know, prior to where you left off. It is with much satisfaction I view this power in the general government, whereby they may lay an interdiction on this reproachful trade. But an immediate advantage is also obtained, for a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation currently. In other words, if it didn't wait till 1808, they currently started taxing the importation of slaves, not exceeding $10 for each person. And this, sir, operates as a partial prohibition. It was all that could be obtained. I'm sorry it was no more, but from this, I think there is reason to hope that yet a few years and it will be prohibited altogether. And in the meantime, the new states which are to be formed, which will be under the control of Congress in this particular, and slaves will never be introduced amongst them. The gentleman says that it is unfortunate in another point of view. It means to prohibit the introduction of white people from Europe, as this tax may deter them from coming amongst us. A little impartiality and attention will discover the care that the convention took in selecting the language. The words are the immigration or importation of such persons, etc., shall not be prohibited by Congress prior to the year 1808, but a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation. It is observable here that the term migration is dropped when a tax or duty is mentioned, so that Congress may have the power to impose the tax only on those imported. So there was the subtle play in the words of migration and imported.
You know, the framers were very skilled with words. And they use that skill with alacrity. I'm always impressed when I read what they have to say, because and these debates bring it forward even more. We don't have an appreciation for words in this time period that they did, and that the power that they had. And these words are just, they are frankly very astute, very clear.
Right.
They talk differently than we do.
Yes.
But the meaning is still very clear.
But they were very deliberate men. And I look at the way they worked with words was like an ironsmith. you know, a man that, you know, bent metal to fit, you know, to create shoes for your horse, or, you know, to create something to, you know, fit something very specific. And so, you know, that word smithing or iron smithing is, you know, that same context of pounding and beating and shaping and framing to be very specific. Absolutely.
It was obvious skill.
So I believe that that right there is a golden egg that actually supports my assertion that the framers did design. See, that no state was to be brought into the Union to be a slave state.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that slavery was going to end. And so as they started bringing in states that, you know, like Tennessee and Kentucky, they actually started allowing slavery, you know, out the gate. But that was only because Congress was denying or actually stepping away from the intent of the Constitution. Because one of the things that happened that same month, or actually the following month of the writing of the Constitution, was this thing called the Northwest Ordinance. And the Northwest Ordinance said that slavery would no longer be admitted to any new state in the Union. Mm-hmm. And then when Congress, in August of 1789, Congress basically accepted the principles in forming new states in the Union of the Northwest Ordinance. So what was the first state that came into the Union?
You mean the first state that ratified?
No, the first state, in other words, the first state that came in as not one of the original 13. What was the 14th state?
The 14th state. It wasn't Vermont, was it?
Yes, it was Vermont. And so Vermont was not a slave state. And Vermont came in 1791, where we had already had a first turnover because the second session of Congress began in 1791, right? The first one was 1789. And so the Kentucky didn't come in until 1792. And so there was enough of a gap from the Northwest Ordinance to the next election to facilitate, you know, a watering down of the mores and the design of the Constitution. I tell people it didn't take long for people to start deviating from the, in 1792, the Assumption Act, as well as allowing Kentucky to join the Union and maintain slavery. Because they clearly violated the principles of the Northwest Ordinance, which they adopted as in Congress in August of 1789.
Right. That's a piece of information.
Yeah, it is. But it's just the design and the spirit of the Constitution as the Lord inspired these men was a very specific direction for this nation. And this is one of the reasons why Mason, because Mason really felt animated, and you can read this, it was August 22nd, and it's in Madison's notes, August 22nd, 1787, where Mason stood up and said, all slave owners are petty tyrants, and that because God can't punish nations, you know, in heaven, he will punish these nations and this nation and these states for allowing slavery to permeate in this new government. And I'm paraphrasing, but anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
What day did you say that was?
August 22nd, 1787. It's okay. In Madison's notes. If you go to the Avalon Project and you look at James Madison's notes on the convention, the Constitutional Convention, you will find that citation in August 22nd where Mason stood up in anger because at that point, what happened was the two Carolinas and Georgia basically said, this is in August, right? The pursuing and the eradicating of slavery in this Constitution was adopted. And they were pursuing it. And those three states were demanding that they kept slavery. Well, it came to a head in August, and it was finally when these three states said, we will leave the Union if you take slavery from us. And that was when, you know, they made this political compromise that they would make slavery a state issue, not a national issue. And the intent was it was going to stop with those three states. Anyway, that they didn't, you know, that was the whole spirit. And you can actually see all of this, you know, when you start reading all of these things, you can see why Mason said that. And then you can see right here where he says it was the design that no new state was to obtain slavery.
So had they followed the Constitution
by design, then slavery would have been eradicated shortly after the importation of slaves. Absolutely.
Shortly after 1808.
Yes.
Okay, got it.
And that's what he was basically saying there. Yep. And so here's, we're just now running into another heartbreak. You know, I guess what I'm going to do for next week is when doing the ratification debates, I am going to forego these hard breaks so that we can actually, you know, now that I have you here, we can just kind of read through the content so we can get more done and discuss more. But anyway, folks, I apologize. I will take care of this next week. We'll be right back.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now we're back. And actually, the next part is the enumerated. And actually, Paul, I want you to pick this up, but it's not the green part. Actually, what we want to read is from the very beginning underneath enumerated. A good deal has already been concerning a Bill of Rights, has been said.
Yeah, that's
fine. Go ahead through. Yeah.
On the last point, I just wanted to remark before we went to the break that, it, contrary to the woke narrative, it is apparent that the Constitution was designed to eradicate slavery from the United States.
Yes.
Okay. I just want to make the point. So how far do you want me to read here? I'm in enumerated.
So, go ahead. This happens to be in your version green, but go ahead and start with a good deal right underneath enumerated and read all the way through the highlighted part.
Okay, here we go. A good deal has already been said concerning a Bill of Rights. I have stated, according to the best of my recollection, all that passed in convention relating to that business. Since that time, I have spoken with a gentleman who has not only his memory, but full notes that he had taken in that body, and he assures me that upon this subject, no direct motion was ever made at all. And certainly before we heard this so violently supported out of doors, some pains ought to have been taken to have tried its fate within. But the truth is, a Bill of Rights would, as I have mentioned already, have been not only unnecessary, but improper. In some governments, it may come within the gentleman's idea when he says it can do no harm. But even in these governments, you find bills of rights do not uniformly obtain, and do those states complain who have them not? It is a maxim in forming governments that not only all the powers which are given, but also that all those which are reserved should be enumerated. I guess that was a question. Is it a maxim in forming governments that not only all the powers which are given, but also that all those which are reserved should be enumerated? I apprehend that the powers given and reserved from the whole rights of the people as men and as citizens, I consider that there are very few who understand the whole of these rights. All the political writers, from Grotius to Pufendorf, down to Vattel, have treated on this subject, but in no one of those books, nor in the aggregate of them all, can you find a complete enumeration of rights appertaining to the people as men and as citizens. There are two kinds of government: that where general power is intended to be given to the legislature, and that where the powers are particularly enumerated. In the last case, the implied result is that nothing more is intended to be given than what is so enumerated, unless it results from the nature of the government itself. On the other hand, when general legislative powers are given, then the people part with their authority, and on that gentleman's principle of government, retain nothing. But in a government like the proposed one, there can be no necessity for a Bill of Rights, for on my principle, the people never part with their power.
Right. And so this is why I have said that the Bill of Rights actually was basically, you know, a dead letter until the civil rights. And it was because the states have been the bad actors in the history of our republic. Mm-hmm. It was needed to apply such a Bill of Rights upon the states, because the states actually had general powers.
Correct.
Well, now most all of the states, though, all had actually in design enumerated constitutions. However, the state legislatures, by playing games over time, would assume powers either because the federal government would give them money or something to that effect. And next thing you know, we just became lackadaisical. We never held our state government accountable because everybody was always had their eye on the federal government as the big bad guy when it's been the states.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so let's jump down to the Supreme portion for reading that section now.
I'm there. Okay. Yeah. It will be worthwhile, Mr. President, to consider this objection at large. When I had the honor of speaking formerly on this subject, I stated in as concise a manner as possible the leading ideas that occurred to me to ascertain where the supreme and sovereign power resides. It has not been, nor I presume will it be denied, that somewhere there is, and of necessity must be, a supreme, absolute, and uncontrollable authority. This, I believe, may justly be termed the sovereign power. For from that gentleman, Mr. Finley, account of that matter, it cannot be sovereign unless it is supreme. For, he says, a subordinate sovereignty is no sovereignty at all. I had the honor of observing that if the question was asked where the supreme power resided, different answers would be given by different writers. I mentioned that Blackstone will tell you that in Britain, it is lodged in the British Parliament. And I believe there is no writer on this subject on the other side of the Atlantic, but supposed it to be vested in that body. I stated further that if the question was asked of some politician who had not considered the subject with sufficient accuracy, where the supreme power resided in our governments, he would answer that it was vested in the state constitutions. This opinion approaches near the truth, but does not reach it. For the truth is that the supreme, absolute, and uncontrollable authority remains with the people. I mentioned also that the practical recognition of this truth was reserved for the honor of this country. I recollect no constitution founded on this principle, but we have witnessed the improvement and enjoy the happiness of seeing it carried into practice. The great and penetrating mind of Locke seems to be the only one that pointed towards even the theory of this great truth.
Now, what's really important, because I always have to caveat this, the supreme authority or the supreme law of the land is the U.S. Constitution, but only those things that are in pursuant to the enumerated powers. In other words, if there is a topic on the delegation of war and, you know, the execution of war, because war is a delegated power that, you know, they can play politics with. They can take us to war and how to do that. But his supposition here is that even then, if the people don't like the war that we're being taken into, in the next election, we can replace everybody in the House of Representatives who would then stop the war and get us out of it. And that's now, the whole point.
There's an observation I want to make here, and you brought it up earlier, that it wasn't until the Civil War that the value of the Bill of Rights actually came into play.
Right.
And back then, they considered an election a check on the government. And now we have a 14th Amendment, which can be a check on the government if we know how to use it.
Well, if we use our First Amendment right of petition, absolutely, that is the direct check.
Right.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So representation is the next subtopic. This is okay. A short one. Go ahead.
I say, sir, that it was the design of this system to take some power from the state governments and to place it in the general government. It was also the design that the people should be admitted to the exercise of some powers which they did not exercise under the present federation. It was thought proper that the citizens as well as the state should be represented. How far the representation in the Senate is a representation of states, we shall see by and by when we come to consider that branch of the federal government.
Right. And he kind of goes on here, and he's actually going through the Congress, but it was just focusing on the fact that even in the Senate, we had, say, Madison even talks about this in the Virginia ratification debates, and I think he even talks about it in the Federalist Papers. He brushes over it. But the point is that who puts those people in your state legislature? The people. Mm-hmm. So the people, if you don't like the senators that your state legislature is selecting, you change out your representation in the state legislature.
Right.
That was the whole point, that the power still was vested in the people regarding representation in both houses of Congress. So anyway, the next topic is jurisdiction. Now, we're just hitting highlights on these points as he's going through this long dissertation here.
Right. Okay. This guy must have had some really good lungs.
Yes.
Okay. Do we wish a return of those insurrections and tumults to which a sister state was lately exposed, or a government of such insufficiency as the present is found to be? Let me, sir, mention one circumstance in the recollection of every honorable gentleman here who hears me. To the determination of Congress are submitted all disputes between states concerning boundary, jurisdiction, or right of soil. In consequence of this power, after much altercation, expensive time, and considerable expense of money, this state was successful enough to obtain a decree in her favor in a difference then subsisting between her and Connecticut. But what was the consequence? The Congress had no power to carry the decree into execution. Hence, I'll finish the paragraph.
Go ahead, yeah.
Hence the distraction and animosity which have ever since prevailed and still continue in that part of the country. Ought the government then to remain any longer incomplete? I hope not. No person can be so insensible to the lessons of experience as to desire it.
Right. So this is where I would have just said this, that under the Articles of Confederation, because Continental Congress could make decrees, they couldn't enforce them. They had no power. And so even though Congress, the Continental Congress, made a decree in favor of Pennsylvania, Connecticut didn't mind and they didn't follow it. But now Congress does have the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union. And as you can probably tell, Paul, we're hitting another hard break. My apologies. These every 12 minutes or so. Next week, we'll take care of this, folks. But anyway, we will be back, and we're going to go ahead and hit the topic commerce that Mr. Wilson covers in this long oration. And so, folks, we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
Set the record straight. Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we're back, and actually, you'll notice that the portion of the commerce that I've highlighted is a little bit down from that paragraph, but it starts with, no man is obligated. And here's an interesting thing. You know, if you think today, you know, are we obligated to buy? Are we obligated to consume or obligated to sell? You know, things have changed to where our central government, the general government, has actually assumed the authority of the power of not only production, but consumption as well. Because we live in under a mercantile system, and most people don't even realize this. But go ahead and start with no man.
No man is obliged to consume more than he pleases, and each buys proportion only to his consumption. The price of the commodity is blended with the tax, and the person is often not sensible of the payment. But would it have been proper to rest the matter here? Suppose this fund should not prove sufficient. Are the public debts to remain unpaid, or the exigencies of government be left unprovided for? Should our tranquility be exposed to the assaults of foreign enemies or violence among ourselves because the objects of commerce may not furnish a sufficient revenue to secure them all? Certainly, Congress should possess the power of raising revenue from their constituents for the purpose mentioned in the 8th section of the 1st article, that is, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. It has been common with the gentlemen on this subject to present us with frightful pictures. We are told of the hosts of tax gatherers that will swarm through the land, and whenever taxes are mentioned, military force seems to be an attending idea. I think I may venture to predict that the taxes of the general government, if any should be laid, will be more equitable and much less expensive than those imposed by state governments.
That's because the state has to actually provide for your internal highways and your waterways and your modes of transportation to provide for the flowing of commerce, where the federal government had no enumerated power over that. As we go through this, just the Department of Transportation alone is a state responsibility that the federal government has no authority to operate the Department of Transportation. Go watch that video, and you will see that that power doesn't exist within the Constitution. So the point is that because the state has the responsibility of the domestic affairs of the state, that they actually have to, if the people really want to provide for education and all these other things, that that becomes a state responsibility. In other words, the cost of taxation from the state would be greater. And actually, the way taxes were to be done, there was the direct way of taxing, like excise tax, like they did with the whiskey tax. There was also duties and impost. And a duty was something that they just basically said, the your state, based on this many, you know, $5 per head, your state needs to give us this much money. And it would be even based on heads or based on apportionment to all the other states. So that's how the duty was done. But excise taxes was a tax that was equally applied to all things. And there were points in time, I just want to bring this up because we're talking about it. Hamilton wanted to actually create an excise tax on the sale of horses. And it was noted that that would be that would not be a uniform. In other words, the consumption of horses is drastically different in the northern states because most people don't have horses in the northern state, only the people in the southern states. So it would have been a greater tax upon the southern states, which is why Congress wouldn't even entertain, because it would violate the uniformity clause. And so when they looked at whiskey, well, everybody consumed whiskey. It was a part, it was a staple. It was like milk. And so anyway, they realized that putting excise taxes on staples and those types of things was a pretty bitter pill to swallow, and they just had a hard time enforcing it, which is why in the early 1800s, they basically got rid of the excise tax on liquor. But they brought it back. And now who's complaining about the excise tax on hard liquor?
Oh, I don't know that anyone's really complaining about it.
That's right, because they were capable of bringing that back after Prohibition was over. So anyway, it's just interesting how they were to do this. But his point here was that the states had much greater responsibilities and their taxation by design was going to be greater, that the federal government wasn't to be providing all of these things. And how did they get out from beyond this parchment boundary? Because they started assuming, because people came to them and said, hey, can you do this? And they started doing it because people did not understand the enumerated powers and the lessons that came from Madison's vetoes, Monroe's vetoes, and so forth. And it was in the 1820s and 30s when the federal government started aggrandizing. It was actually John Quincy Adams that actually used federal funds to help assist with the integration of rail transportation in America, because it was seen as a real advantage. And he violated the Constitution in doing that. And look at the problem we have with rails today. Anyway.
Sure.
Anyway, I'm sorry for all the additional anecdotal information. Let's go to the necessary and proper clause now.
Well, it's news that needs to be understood. So I'm necessary and proper.
Yes.
Here we go. It is urged as a general objection to this system that, quote, the powers of Congress are unlimited and undefined, and that they will be the judges in all cases of what is necessary and proper for them to do, end quote. To bring this subject to your view, I need do no more than point to the words in the Constitution, beginning at the 8th section, Article 1st. Quote, the Congress, it says, shall have power, end quote, etc. I need not read over the words, but I leave it to every gentleman to say whether the powers are not as accurately and minutely defined as can be well done on the same subject, in the same language. The old Constitution is as strongly marked on this subject, and even the concluding clause, with which so much fault has been found, gives no more or other powers, nor does it in any degree go beyond the particular enumeration. For when it is said that Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper, those words are limited and denned by the following, quote, for carrying into execution the foregoing powers, end quote. It is saying no more than that the powers we have already particularly given shall be effectually carried into execution. Really clear statement. You know the necessary and proper clause is so abused.
Sure, yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, they don't understand. Maybe they do understand. Okay, but it should be understood that it's necessary and power under the limited authority of the Constitution.
Right. And I'll go as far as to add this, because we have talked, and I talk a lot about definitizing the Constitution. In other words, every single one of these definitions of the necessary and proper clause will prove a mountain of evidence that it was already, this is the second time it was brought up in this debate. It was brought up in every debate that was vigorously debated of the Constitution. And my point is this, folks, they say the exact same thing, that clause is limited to the aforegoing powers and only those powers. And so how is it that, you know, we got out of that? How is, because a judge made an opinion, and his name was John Marshall, that whatever the federal government deemed necessary and proper was what they could do constitutionally. And that began the growth and usurpation, even though there is no mention in the Constitution that precedents, case law, and opinion can be used to amend the Constitution. That's exactly what they're doing.
Right.
And so all of these things, all caps, capital A, capital L, capital L, all they're doing is unconstitutional. So when we look at the problems that we're facing, it's a house of cards. They have no authority to be doing all of these things. All we have to do is just a puff of breath and the cards will fall. Mm-hmm. This is why we talk to, and I bring on these sovereign citizen folks to talk about, you know, what they're doing and how they believe that all of this stuff is legitimate, that the federal government legitimately created corporations. They have no authority to do that. It's all fraud. Anyway. Sure. Let's wrap up. We don't even have time because we got 20 seconds left. Any parting shots?
It's been good to understand this, because what we've got is the last couple things we have. These are abused parts of the Constitution that the founders clarify.
Yes.
Are not to be abused. Okay. Yes. Commerce and necessary and proper.
Yes.
We'll get into commerce, I'm sure.
All right. Well, we finally reached a point where nobody can hear what you're saying, because the music is going to drown you out and it's going to drown me out, because we've come to the end. Folks, we will be back on Monday with the ratification debates, and tomorrow we've got Feedback Friday. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.